going to switch myself over.
Remember what?
Maybe you should sit next door.
Initial question for me, and I'll hand over to Commissioner Hudson. What are your viewpoints from the road? Did you consider the visibility from the lake?
Not under this mapping. It was done as I remember in the original, I think in the original application, but I would have to look that up for you. But this mapping was based on the road.
Are you able to comment on visibility from the lake?
It's been a very long time since I've been out there. I was there prior to the original application being launched, but no, I won't comment on that.
Okay, thank you.
It is not too dissimilar to the Glen View Club. Obviously, it's a slightly different angle, but it's about the same distance within the bay. And I can provide an answer to the question whether the density of the line reflects the distance. So yes, because it's like a ray that comes out of the point, the further away, the more distance there is between the bays. So if you look at site 2, for example, you can see the green lines are quite close to each other, so that's a viewpoint near the Greenburn Ridge, which is quite nearby. There's the deck line which are from Greenburn Ridge, which is near
the That was my assumption, I just
wanted
to get it right.
Yes.
Oh, that's preliminary. Points? Commissioner Hudson.
Thank you. I'm probably not in a particular order, but in your evidence, you referred to the assessment of the additional house site as being up to 3.8 metres high. The proposed zone provision would allow 4 metres. How much difference might there be from an additional 200 millimetres on any one or all of the
So, the reason that it was done at 3.8 metres was to be consistent with the modelling 2008 in order to be able to provide that comparison. So if you look in the table appendix 3, where it's now said, for example, partial less than 1 metre, it's at a height of 4 metres, as opposed to 3.8, it's got more than 50 partial visibility of less than 1.2 metres. So the 20 centimetres would have to be added on to anything in the green line if the buildings were at a height of 4 metres.
Is it possible that additional 20 centimetres, 200 millimetres could make a difference between the building's not being seen at all versus a perception that yes, there is a building or that it's then possible to see that there are lots of residential buildings?
Well, I mean, 20 centimetres is about
what is it?
So, I mean, if you imagine that at a viewing distance of 500 metres to a kilometre, it's very, very small. So I think what's more important in that respect is the type of material and the colour. So if you, I mean, even if you had a blank page at a distance of 500 metres, you might be able to just see it. But if that's part of the building, it's had a colour or a texture, you know, material that blends in with the surroundings, I don't think that every sort of 20 centimetres makes a difference. I think the key is that it's the material.
In paragraph 9 of your supplementary evidence, you referred to a setting of 50 consistently designed grains. What do you mean by that?
So, I mean, I think that the design of the building is important, and I was in support of developing the assessment methods. water buildings and with the food from the mesh up. The next evidence will go through them in a little bit more detail. But that they referred to the choice of materials to try to avoid the lunar, for example, by having eaves or non-reflective glass. I think those things are very important. And it's also, I don't think that the buildings all need to be the same, because you will see various parts of various buildings, but I think there should be a consistent design. So a consistent choice of a material and colour palette, I think it's important to provide a view of the development where not everything looks completely different. So, yeah, and I think that steps through the assessment methods will provide enough. I mean, having seen that with other developments like the checkpoint, for example, where Janet Green Street Garden Gardens, I think that's a good approach for people to finish those
decisions. This being a very large scale site with some activity areas, it is to me that different developers or different individuals may be responsible for different design decisions. For example, the golf course, completely separate set of design parameters and different people involved in that very specialised sort of design, compared with the dwelling or for that matter, the campground facilities or lakeside building or farmhouse site. Mr. Thompson said he didn't think it was necessary for buildings to be hygienous. In your opinion, from a landscape perspective, what if the converse happens and there are significant differences in style or character of building over the whole zone?
I think that they need to be consistent within the community area. So for example, the residences, they should be consistent because they'll set quite specifically on specific home sites, and that's where the location of the assessment letters for those buildings is important. Equally, I think for something like the Homestead area or the Kendra area, for example, is also in support of having a spatial layout plan for the campground area to ensure that it is a homogeneous design, that it's not, you know, all sorts of things happening without an overall planning. So, but then these areas are actually spatially and visually quite separated, so you don't perceive them together. And often in terms of perceived activity, they're quite different. So you've got the existing campground, and I think the campground activity area as part of the zone will be visually much more associated with the existing campground than it would be with the residence, for example. So I think that's important to keep the consistency within each of the activity areas, but less so. You wouldn't expect the residence to be exactly the same as the accommodation along the lake shore, for example. There will be design differences probably around use of local materials that I imagine would be similar, but they're quite different sort of things. And I think the lakeshore area is more a much more public point, and it's not, the goal is not to hide it. You know, it's an attraction, and people will go there as a destination as well, you know, we've discussed before. So I think the goal was not to make those buildings invisible in any case. But I think there's two different things, and I think within the area it should be consistent, but I don't necessarily think that the goal, of course, makes them come down the erect the temporary outlook. Yeah,
so going back to the residences, you were involved in the environment court hearing?
I didn't give evidence here. I was involved in the preparation of the additional report and the community's case for that study.
Well, your understanding that the actual design of the residences was a matter that was of some importance and so you puzzle the visual landscape in the dimension?
I'm not sure, I need to read up on the dimension of that.
What I'm getting at is that there was a reference in there to the court decision to the specific design, and I wondered if, in your opinion, the opportunity that the zone provision would make for something quite different is in the area of your conclusion of the language of visual effects.
Well, I can only give you my opinion because I'm not exactly sure how the court would look at the court at the time or what the court would think about what's proposed.
Oh, yeah. What about the, you know, just need to be clear as to these areas that you referred to for the eight additional sites. How do they compare with the consented site? Has there been any change to the area for the consented site? We talked about tweaking the location of the additional eight within the pods that were originally without consented. So how do they compare with what has been consented? Is there any overall change in the area for any of the sites?
For the consented one?
The consented one.
Well, there, I know that there has been a recent use of consent application to change the URL for three or four, of the site. That has been approved recently, and I've provided the landscape assessment support for that, so I could comment on that. Other than that, I don't think any of the consensus sites have changed in the URL.
Okay, I just wanted to understand the much difference between the eight additional ones, the ones that have been considered.
I can't tell you that about each one of the sites, but there's a table of things that is older URL. So you could look, for example, in comparison to home site to what is home site one. I mean they'd be similar. Because quite often they would sit in a cluster on the same carriage, for example, home site 2, the JSON to home site 1. And so home site 1, for example, has an RL that's 3 or 4.5, and home site 2 has got RL 3 or 5. So they're on the same carriage, so they have very similar levels. But I don't have it in my fingertips how they all relate to each other. But I have been out on the site and I've seen them safe. And yeah, they're quite, it's an obvious choice when you're out there. Yeah, you wouldn't pick them in square walls or less than the conventional.
Would you consider it important to assess the visibility of the zone as a whole, but in particular the residents that are from elevated land? For example, public viewpoints at Lord's Peak, or for that matter, the proposed walking track?
So I think in terms of cumulative effects, that's where the cumulative effects would arise for that entire zone. That's also where you see all the existing developments together with the consensus work. So I think where it would probably make a difference is for the campground area, where you currently have quite a it's intensively used campground on one side of the road but not on the other one. I think actually for the 8 additional home sites you wouldn't be able to really perceive 8 more because you already see 42. I think the cumulative effect from an elevated viewpoint even would be very small for that. Equally for the farm homestead area, there are already a lot of buildings in that area. I don't think we would see the cumulative effect as a big difference. And the same for the natural when you have to complete the clubhouse and the shares for the accommodation. But yeah, I agree that from elevated viewpoints, the most likely to see cumulative effects. Whereas if you travel along the road or even on the lake, you see parts of it at different times.
So you would if it's not already in the zoning booking, you would expect to see a specific reference to the visibility from elevation viewpoint?
Well, I think it's very difficult to avoid that. And to be clear, I've been up there quite recently at the time, and you can see the reports from the bus, and you will see that existing and potential development on the bus as well. So, yeah, because of a reference to the cumulative effect, I don't know if it is particularly relevant, but.
I'm not sure whether this is within your area or not, but there are a number of references in the zoning position demo, even if it's experience, which is on my thought board as well, to the eventual revegetation of the moraine area. So, he's nodding. Can you please comment on this is your area of expertise on what you anticipate by eventual revegetation of that area? What is involved in
this vegetation? Well, I can try to answer. I mean, under the various stages, there are the areas of mitigation planting and the regeneration, and that's revegetation. And there are different things. So the revegetation, for example, in the gully is where the next is planted in that niche. Yeah. As far as I'm aware, the regeneration is just where it's placing its river and it's next to naturally regenerate.
The reference to eventual regeneration, are you able to clarify what you understand is meant by that?
Well, it will, because it is natural, it is something that happens over time, that doesn't, because there's no additional planting, it is dependent on the seed sources coming in, and that happens over time, so eventual means it will take a little bit longer than if you plant it.
But that's not something that needs to be fixed by rules relating to stages or other methods to ensure it.
Well, I think the removal of the grading is what makes a big difference in that respect, and that's something that I've noticed in vulnerable catchment sites in the residential area, with the stock being removed from near the grasses have grown, and so have the shrubs, both native in the tropics. So that actually happens reasonably quickly, but to have a completely coherent native the shrubland, that takes a little bit of time.
Now, this side is an area of course. In your opinion, once this site is developed either in accordance with the existing consent, or for some other form that's enabled at the time, what will that do to the owner on the presentation?
Well, I can tell you similar examples because I've done that one over in various other districts in the South Island. So my view would be, if there's a VRL next to it, I would probably exclude the developed area based on the modifications, because in my view, once you've got such an intensive mode of development, the natural aspect of old NL has been lowered to the point where I wouldn't consider it to be moderate to high anymore, which is the threshold. So, so based on the scale of the overall O&L and of the development area, I understand the argument that it's too small to be a landscape in itself. And I agree with that. And based on that, I said, okay, it can be considered just as part of the OIL because it is not a separate membership. Based on the values of the modification, the services next to it are actually not considered to be impacted by the national membership anymore, but are not considered to be big enough to be a membership.
So I surmise from what you said that there would be a case to remove the ONL classification from it in the future.
I think there would be in terms of the modification.
One of the bigger issues that we have been wrestling with as a panel and the strategic and the other things is whether development in an ONL is disqualified. The classification of the land that's occupied by the ONL. Do you have development and accept that there is development in an ONL, or what? Does it mean something else?
Well, this has been taken
on
a few environment court cases where there was a lot of argument about is it a landscape, and that's part of the environment standards and the evidence that we, that's what the other experts are coming from. It's not big enough to be a landscape in itself. But I'd be interested to see what other people would think about seeing this or the national next, whether that would be compromised to the point that it shouldn't be a environment anymore.
Can I just explore that a little bit, Christian? If I understood your first answer to the question, if, for instance, Motokapu Road had previously been the boundary between the ONL line and the VAL, this development might cause in the future the line to shift to the ONL line, to shift to the other side of, to the west and south, the other side of the development. Is that what you mean?
Why would it be
Motokapu?
It wasn't
Motokapu
Road.
Well, yeah, but it's a
hard deal. Right, okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was doing.
But you said, I think what I wrote down was, if it was a vowel expert, you'd probably now exclude it based on the development.
Mm-hmm.
So what I understood from that is, if it previously the boundary had been, for instance, the road, this development would cause the ONL line to shift.
That's what I'm doing. I'm making this.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that I understood that.
But that would include both the, so that exclusion of the ONL would include the consented and the existing, like the Kendra, the existing Kendra. I wouldn't put that as part of the
ONL. Paragraph 48 of your evidence sheet, first sentence, you said the visibility of the consented development would be lower than the potential visibility of buildings if they were to be located on the western side of the proposed lakeshore activity area. I wasn't quite clear about what you meant.
Which paragraph was that?
48. This is in relation to the lakeshore activity area.
Yeah, I'm happy to explain it. As I can point you to my briefing attachment, she's going to get it. So, looking at the photo, the viewpoint 11. Above the photograph on the left hand side, it shows lakeshore activity area.
Yeah.
So this photo is taken from Glenview Bluff. And I don't know if I can explain this. On the right hand side of the lakeshore activity area, you can see those poplars.
Yeah.
And that the area where the buildings are currently contented. So you can see that the small headland that protrudes just to the right of it, it kind of usually confines that area, and so the visibility of the contented buildings in this area would be lower than if they were further to the left, which is also further than the lateral activity area.
Isn't that what is proposed in the zone? It's just that it's definitely
the position. That's right, so it would be more visible in the zone, yeah.
From this viewpoint.
From this viewpoint, that's right, yeah.
But the end is that their potential visibility wouldn't necessarily be those
measures. Well, that comes back to what I said before. I actually think that the lateral activity area is a point of attention. It's at the head of the bay, it's the clubhouse, it's the public exit, it's got a jetty. It's actually an area where you draw people to. And it's not something that, in my view, should be hidden or needs to be hidden. So I would feel, in terms of the character, feel quite comfortable with buildings being potentially more visible in that location.
I want to talk to you, please, about your paragraph 33C, the Urban Sheet. You talk to the removal of a residential pile on the northern side of the road. I've seen on the structure case I have, the pile one that is similar to me, which appears to be in the middle of Spicer's driveway. The thing I didn't understand is that the 42 consented houses are all along sites on the hill. So what was envisaged to be in that pond?
Yeah, I wasn't sure either, and I didn't think it was a good idea.
Was that right?
I didn't think it was a really good spot for it, and my advice was to not put it there.
So at what point was that discarded as an option?
Prior to preparation of
the evidence. Well, I suppose what I don't understand is if there are 42 house sites on the hill above the road and there's only 42 consented, what did the residential pod ever consist of?
I think it was for an additional 80, wasn't it? Yeah.
So that was, in terms of where we talk about 50 originally applied for, 42 consented. The 8 were on the north side of the road.
I think that was contemplated at one point.
We should ask Mr. Ferguson these questions.
Cool. Yeah, I didn't think it was an appropriate location for those in my place to remove that post.
I think, sorry, if I can look and not be unhelpful. The structure plan is attached to the submission. Didn't identify the pods, or the little pods, the individual 42 pods. It only identified the very large members within which the total of 15 would sit. Whereas the revised version went back to identifying the 42 consented pods and the additional 8 specific pods being sought. So instead of having a large residential activity area blobs without specifying specific locations, we've gone back to that level of specificity.
So when you say the structure plan that might be applied, that was as per the original
submission. Yeah.
And what I'm not understanding is the consent identified 42 sites on the hill.
Yes.
So it's beautiful sites, generalised,
right. Yeah.
One of the other things I remember from before, a question you had about the golf compound, which I'm able to answer, is there's a golf facility overlay in the corner where the...
Can you stroll up to the corner and point out what...
It's not very visible because it's got a grey head on the grey background, but it's in here, and it is labelled here as golf facilities overlay. And
then
it's in the same area
that
the
maintenance
compound
is
completed.
Yeah.
So you're worried about it. Is that right? Yeah. Still quite basic. Keep them white. Chow cell. This is a tricky one. Yes. The question here is really about buildings outside that overlay area. Dr. Reed didn't have a concern about expanding the golf course of the Fernburn Delta, but she did have a concern about putting golf course related buildings in that area. What's your view?
Well, there's a setback for buildings anyway. 20 meter setback on the Fernburn.
Yeah.
There's also an earthwork setback of 30 meters. So that would prevent putting it within the Fernburn margins. Also, they're actually quite steep terraces, so I don't think it would be particularly practical to, in the upper part, on the southern side of the mountain spire roads, the terraces become quite steep in this area, so it wouldn't be a feasible idea to put buildings there anyway, I would
think. So you wouldn't have an issue if there was another overlay in that additional area, say, no buildings, which is what Dr. Reed was suggesting, if you say, well, it wouldn't be feasible anyway.
I haven't looked at the exact area in detail, but I think that would be okay,
yeah. From our site visit, I visualised where it was pointed out to us, we looked down at it, and it's quite a noticeable zip where the golf course area is proposed to be expanded into,
mm-hmm.
which is presumably why it appeals to Mr. Thompson, complete with ecologically sensitive crack willows.
I think that would be right. I think it would be good to contain the facilities buildings
talking about the camping ground area, paragraph 37, you say it's restricted discretionary SLP. What's that SLP stand for?
It's the spatial layout change. And so it's in paragraph 35, just after the bold
attempt. Oh, yes, thank you for that.
Yeah. And that's a restricted discretionary activity to create a spatial layout change. And I actually think that that's an important aspect of it. so that you can ensure a consistent design and layout of the area. And I think it's part of that you would also consider where you would want to have areas of vegetation, and that will be influenced by kind of operational requirements and amenity and things like that.
The last sentence of your 37, you consider it's important to ensure that buildings are located at the back of terraces, Wakeham Road, mm-hmm. edge of the upper terrace.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if that's important, mm-hmm. should that be locked into the plan with the building restriction area?
I think it's part of the assessment that under the restricted discretionary consent that buildings are set back from the road and the edge of the terrace.
Yeah, but how far should they be set back? Please don't tell me what's in the rules. Tell me what you think is your opinion of how far they should be set back as a landscape architect.
If you think that's sold out,
right.
I'm not trying to be too evade the question. If you would try to reduce the visibility, if you want to have double story buildings, I think they shouldn't be on the lower terrace, but they should be on the upper terrace, the base of the upper terrace, where you could actually avoid visibility from the road. I'll show you on my viewpoint 1. So the lower terrace, which is the one that needed to be adjacent to the road, that's quite often invisible. So, I would recommend to have three story buildings on there. But I don't know the exact distance, how wide that terrace is, but based on these ones, you could probably set the single story building against the terrace with the backdrop and with appropriate planting.
I suppose the question for me arising out of that is that if the building camping ground set back at nearest to the base of that terrace,
mm-hmm.
are they in fact going to be separated and unconnected to the existing camping ground?
Well, I actually think this is quite a good example. So if you look here, you're on the road and you see quite a lot of buildings, especially just on the right.
Different question, the question is, if the rationale having the camping grounds on that land is to integrate with the existing camping grounds,
yeah.
are you in fact losing that integration if you set it back, right from the back of the lower terrace or ultimately to the top terrace, so that the whole concept
caravans and camperlands and tents and all that in that area. So I'm not saying that it wouldn't be in the campground at all, but I think double-story buildings should be set back so that they're not fishing commonly.
Right, I think that's the missing link. So you're not saying
the campground activity area should be set back. I'm talking specifically about the building.
The caravans and tents are okay.
Yeah, which would be quite similar to what's happening on the other side of the road.
And in relation to the camping ground, one of the questions I have asked.
That would all be considered as part of the collection they have there.
I'm very excited. In Christmas in January, Leonard Bay camping ground is like a seething mass of people and activities and teams and caravans. In terms of landscape effects, should the if the camping ground over the road is moved to a building focus as opposed to current camping ground, which is much more caravans and tents, you have multiple cabins, for instance, or motel units, like a top 10 type operation. Does there need to be some constraint on the number of buildings from a landscape perspective? So the site have open locations?
Well, I think it'd be appropriate to just consider this part of the overall development. It really depends a bit on the layer and how you are able to integrate it with the exit, with your planting areas. I actually think it doesn't make sense to pick a number. We discussed that as part of the options of what we could put forward, and we did talk about trying to decide on a number, but actually I think it is better to have a spatial layout plan that can be considered comprehensively rather than setting a specific number. Because it depends on the scale of each unit, and we had all these discussions, how big will the opinion, how much space will it really depends how you design the whole thing, so I think it's better to do a comprehensive design.
And so what's the appropriate test of how much is too much?
Someone will have to assess it as a restricted
discretionary service. Yeah, but they have to assess it against a series of criteria. Mr. Ferguson's put his best foot forward. What's your criteria, or criterion, or criteria as to how much is too much development on the camping ground? Because I have in my mind's eye rows of cabins that I have seen at other camping grounds.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to see rows and rows of it. I would prefer to see probably small clusters and kind of sensitively price it in accordance with the landform rather than having them as rows. And I wouldn't want to see a double story motel right next to the road, so that's why my response was to if there's a double story development on it, which may affect on the motel unit, there would be better prices on the tech side of the upper terrace. But often you can design cabins quite attractively, and they can look quite good. They would probably look better than the toilet box on the existing one.
All right. just overall, the campground for me. There's a lot of mention of being a campground extension. Was this going to be back to the council? Because it's not an extension of the campground, it's a competition, it's the second campground. So.
Yeah, I think it's just next people pregnant.
Yeah.
It's not assumed that it will be
this in
the
afternoon,
it might be something that
they're afraid of
taking themselves.
Yeah, my imagination is that they probably would. So it's actually a second campground.
Yeah.
And I think that someone, might have been Mr. Darby, was making a virtue out of that, saying if you could depopulate the council campground big season, that would be no bad thing. Commissioner McLeod, any other questions?
Well, again, on the, we've traversed the campground and you've made reference that there's no natural character of flats in relation to the campground in relation to visibility, but obviously there will be in terms of the rows of potential rows of tents, buildings, huts, whatever. And it then just becomes a case of how best to control or mitigate or deal with that issue. And then it gets into the same argument about should this be a zone or should this be by consent. Yeah,
it's a tough one. I'm
rambling and aiming to myself. Visibility of the consented development is, and you compared it to the visibility of the potential buildings compared to the. I'm struggling with the eight, the random eight that when Amy came out, came back in, and I take your point that it's not a great increase, but there's 3% difference in the DNA of me and a chimpanzee, so a small increase can make a big difference, is what I'm saying. I thought that was quite an analogy. I should have actually said Trevor and a chimpanzee compared to that. I don't know if I'd have got away with that, you know. But the line then becomes when is enough too much. Your view is that a 20% increase in the permitted sites is acceptable.
Well, the reason I come to this view is because the visual effect is going to be so small. If they were fully visible, I think an additional 2 could be unacceptable. Yeah, but for me, it came down to finding good locations for them, having mitigating mounding and vegetation around them to reduce their visibility to a point where the visibility is going to be so low that there's no extra visual effect. And that's something that the submitter was willing to work together with me based on the advice to reduce the visual effect to a point that it will not be adverse. And it's not necessarily numbers. I mean, we could probably fit 10 additional ones in if you manage to do that, or you could put in 2, and the effect is going to be greater than the other 42. So I think that's the kind of deciding factor, if it was for me.
And for example, a row of camper vans along the side of the road might be a much more intrusive effect than a naturally built-in consuming tax.
Yeah. And for me, the camper vans are acceptable because you already see camper vans in one place. You'll see them at exactly the same time, but visually in exactly the same catchment. I wouldn't encourage to have the camping facility extending along the road, for example, but you can see them together. So that was the reason why I
considered
that.
Google's advocate question would be, is the current clashing with the right description, chaos of the council and camping ground on one side, acceptable from a landscape point of view, because you've got the green fields on the other side of the road? If you had chaos on both sides, it's certainly going to be more chaotic, but is that going to be an issue from a landscape point of view?
Well, why wouldn't you then remove all camping because I put everything in my house? But I think it will be the same sort of effect. But I don't think you're outweighing one by seeing something nice. No, not from my mind.
Sorry.
There's quite an interesting another phrase that you could that you use, which is limited liberalisation. I was wondering if you could expand on that. That was something you said, actually. The objectives and policies above note the quality and importance of the landscape, a rule framework that would allow for limited liberalisation of future development within the proposed zone.
Yeah, Which
paragraph? So that's paragraph 82. Okay. There it is. Right. I'll see you on the next page. This is such a thing. I was just wondering what the...
Oh, no.
It's a bit of
being half pregnant. I might have to read paragraph 6.12 in relation to this, because it might well be a phrase that she used a lot to paraphrase. It's not one that I use a lot. But what I'm trying to say is that the rule framework, if it's been, would allow a similar sort of development that's not out of character in terms of the strictness of the rule framework or what's possible. I think that's important in that it's an important landscape. So I feel comfortable with the rule framework providing enough guidance in
Maybe give some time further for the person.
Now, do you want, given the time of day, would you like to choose from what you're reading in them? No.
No, and yes.
Do you see copies?
This question I had is on paragraph 5.25, where you talk about a mix of housing opportunities being realised. And it was my understanding, based on the overall account of the evidence from Mr. Bixabi and other witnesses, that this proposal for the resort is more realistically tourism focused, and I wondered if you could just clarify what you meant by housing opportunities in the room.
I think that was in the context of the strategic direction objectives. there was perhaps not a reference within the development, but of the realisation of housing opportunities generally within the district. So this of course has one type of housing opportunity, it's not full spectrum. And nor is it low density, nor is it a high density housing, so it fits within the spectrum of available housing opportunities for the district. Of a certain type and a certain quality that would appeal to a certain group of people.
Going to paragraph 7 of 10, we talked about the RPA's relationship achieved through covenant areas being removed in the structure plan, and the reason being that you get areas are adequately protected by the covenants themselves, together with provisions of chapter 72 of the plan. My question on that is whether or not there's any merit in public identification of covenants or protected areas through these being shown on the map and overlays that are associated with the proposed zone. Because you know, tax areas should have, but not normally, as far as I'm aware, identified on the map.
No, they're not identified in the same maps, usually.
Yeah.
Obviously, they have a surface, but I don't think there would be any harm in including an overlay as well. Just obviously conscious of the certification, but I don't see any harm in having that here as well.
It does seem to be quite an important part of the overall package to have this particular area. And it couldn't be recognised as part of the information that a member of the public might
readily understand more if it was on the same map than what they would if they didn't know about the CVC. Yes, if I'd agree.
Yeah, so you don't see any issues in terms of what you're supporting in doing it, but is there a particular reason why they had to be removed?
Well, it was just more about the situation that I said that there was a perception, and in order to avoid that perception, I would be quite happy to see them put in place. That answered the question.
Thank you. Now, turn to your consideration of the proposed lakeshore activity area in paragraph 7.37. You talked about a proposed set of rules relating to building height and gross floor area buildings of 3,500 that align directly with the scale of building anticipated by the environment court. Now, one thing that I'm not clear on is where these numbers actually sit in the environment court decision or in how that compare. Can you clarify that?
My understanding is they don't sit within the decision itself directly as a figure. There is, however, a set of approved plans and drawings that do sit within the environment court decision. I've taken advice of the design team with our partners in terms of scaling that floor area, and that's how 3,500 square metres was arrived at. Was the scale of the measurement of the plans. It wasn't a figure that was directly available or stated within the decision, to the best of my knowledge.
So that applies to other proposed rules where the various numbers have been included, limits on floor area to various certificates, which I want to deal with in some detail when we go through the zone provision.
Yes, well, generally that would be the case. I mean, to the agreement of the farm homestead, for example, that's based on not so much the course setting, but the measurements of the existing buildings that are on the area. So if that made available through study partners to me on my request, so to understand the scale of that existing building, which, looking out, that's just the but generally, if there is a figure put in the drawings, sorry, in the provisions that would have been made on that sort of discussion and analysis. So I have here Mr. Tatar, who's a member of the Design from the Valley Partners, who might be able to assist us with the measurement of the numbers.
We can consider that, but I'm not asking for that. I just wanted to understand how you got to these numbers. In the same paragraph, you commented that the court decision is descriptive, and as designs evolve, the strict application of the resource consultation would not provide the training and development needs except by way of future further application. What I wanted to ask you is where you or how the zone provisions ensure that the same level of mitigation that was inherent in the court's decision to grant consent is achieved. To go back to comments that we've, I think, all individually made, the court decision seems to be fairly fine and nuanced. It's got over the line eventually, but with the process that took it there.
Right.
And so, how do you see that the proposed zone will reach that same balance level of development versus mitigation?
Well, I think the tension would be with the Lakeshore Act, the process of the mitigation in terms of the wider landscape mitigation possibility, although I think that the components of the location is defining where the SV river is, but rather on the design and the appearance of the building is an important factor in my view, and that was part of the exercise of control and the control activities for the buildings. That's an important part of assessing the suitability of an alternative or future building design. The second thing is, aside from the design, I try to list the extent across the zone. I try to capture lots of the parameters that are also important in terms of framing up what could be a possible adverse effect. So that would include simply height, setbacks, or overall mass of building, which in the cases has been proposed at 3.5 meters. So that, together with the controls of the building, I consider giving an alternative path to write in a design that would be of a similar standard of policy in terms of its effects on the environment.
How did you determine that an additional 1,000 square metres would be justified?
Well,
as an IDA?
That was just a possibility that was put to me by my client about potential for a growing mass of it possible. And I said, well, look, we're running a very fine line in terms of not wanting to extend scale buildings in that area. And that if there was a possibility for the placement of a building of a limited scale and of a limited effect, then I thought it would be appropriate to do that through the restricted discretion activity status. So that the council, if they weren't satisfied on the design of the building, its placement or its effects, they could have that ability to define it. So anything over and above 1,000 square metres would be controlled further, and I think it becomes other full discretion and not defined, which is rules.
Well, it's a question of whether we go through these details now or when we go through the provisions.
I was just making sure that there was an appropriate framework that should that possibility be taken up, that there was a robust assessment that could be made, and it has been put around there.
And there are various other provisions for increases in building footprint and other activity areas. Okay. An additional 500 metres to another zone, but I don't know which one, but what I'm getting to is...
There's a threshold, I think. I'm sure we've got additional, but we've got, certainly got some thresholds around the parking areas, the parking homes here in the area. And that was more of a landscape looking in place of the permissions, which was to ensure that actually scale driven. There was an appropriate system of maintenance scale along the effect visually and on the landscape values on the special scale building that across that site. Otherwise, I can't think of any increase in coverage apart from obviously if you were building outside of the home site right away. Again, other stretches of shrewdly fight with the chicken if you were building outside of the mansion.
When it goes through all these provisions, start looking at tentative effects of all these possible extra cohesives, extra height, extra residential dwellings, more visitor accommodation, additional floor area, natural area, campground area, completely open. Sounds like a sea. How does the potential scale and intensity of a large area of campground get assessed? And how does that generally affect the evaluation?
Well, I think I deal with campground first because that one's you see that was the intent of the approach of using the spatial layout panel to address the layout of the buildings, its relationship to the open space and mitigation and contents in an integrated way. So that there is that ability to look at cumulative effects in a coherent way. The second aspect about the campground is in itself relating to what the activity area provides for. So the structure can activity will provide for deliberate accommodation, grey caps, limited to camping grounds or camping grass, cracking smooth, cracking grass location. Camping grounds is a defined term that's included within the proposed district plans and links to some regulations, camping ground regulations, where it's also a defined term. So that is a known term to include that what the rest around mobile vehicles or caravans or campers or tents. It does also make provisions for cabins, to a degree, not quantified as what that would mean to the scale, however. But what it doesn't include is the type of visitor accommodation units that you might expect, say, in another visitor accommodation development that wholly is accommodation that's uncoupled or not related to camping grounds. So part of it, if you like, part of this secondary frame of what you're thinking about in terms of camping area is camping ground activities rather than wholesale sort of accommodation.
Well, just while we're on that subject, yes, I went to have a look at that the definition of those regulations, and it seemed to be completely wide open. You could, if not constrained by bulk and location, you could have a seven-storey apartment block that would be within that definition because it focuses on independent living.
Right.
Well, look at that. And without being specific as to where and how that independence is maintained.
Right.
So I suppose can I just signal that in terms of the constraint we've identified, when I looked at the regulation that I wrote in my margin, what constraints?
And also your motel type accommodation seems to be something that you wish it can be considered.
Well, obviously, as I read it, the camping ground regulations were concerned about the types of activities that provided for, and it's not all in any way limited to the scale of that commitment from the mission office and where the country is. I thought it was rather confined to talk about terrorism. I appreciate that there's a scale of that that needs to be addressed. But within the overall definition of Missouri Foundation, there is a duration of stay component. So it fits within the Foundation of the country. So you can't, for example, there was a body question that I think was going through to Mr. Carr about the potential for that area to be developed as housing, and that is not, in my view, fit within the definition of either a physical accommodation or the structured plan activity rule, which specifically does not provide for residential accommodation in the campground. So that, at that point, if you like, the duration of stay, I'm going to accept the 3 months, you're slipping into residential accommodation. Residential accommodation is not provided for.
Are you saying that 3 months is one of the regulations about?
It's the definition of visitor accommodation. So within that definition, you have the duration of stay of at least 3 months.
And if you then go on holiday for a week and come back, does that tell you to another 3 months?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess this was there. I mean, there could be a potential enforcement issue there, but, if somebody was signing a residential tenancy agreement, like, for example, that would be one way in which you can sort of easily capture and understand that. But for anything else, I guess that's just the way the district deals with this accommodation in general terms.
You've also referred to it in relation to the Lakeshore area and activity area specifically consented by the Environment Court in paragraph 7.41, but it raises a wider question that I have, and I think my commissioners do too. And that is, despite the fact we have read the court decision, we aren't privy to all of the information, obviously, that the court took into account in reaching its finding. And in regard to the consent conditions, we explained the plans, and you've already explained that some of your building footprints are based on strength. Now, what I think we need to understand is, in a broader sense, how what was consented by the court it now translates, in terms of each condition, now translates into the provision incorporated into the zone.
I see, right, yes. So, condition by condition.
Pretty much. Now, seeing that in one of the briefs of evidence, it's a big ask, but on the one hand you are relying on the court's decision as part of the existing environment to which we are in regard, and on the other we don't know how the existing environment might be incorporated into the zone.
So the translation, if you like.
The translation.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Okay. I think what would assist us is a table by condition, and I think I correct my colleague. We do have plans, but of course looking at a plan without the kind of skill that the Derby design team have to derive sizes, we are none the wiser. So I think what we would like, please, is for you to go down. I wonder if we do it in by condition. Say, where has this condition gone? And specifically and separately, all those plans, because it's a condition one, it's condition two, says everything subject to the attached plans. which is incredibly interesting and not very helpful for us, because you can't decipher what the plans mean and what they require when translated into words, which is what you've done.
Just to clarify, I did, I mean, I referred to the decision and the plans, but they, they're at very small scale.
Well, that's right.
It's quite regional, actually.
And it's formulated.
Even what's the meaning of
that? So it's formulated some of the rules that we have. We've had to dive deeper than what's just included in condition one as well. So, for example, the elevation plans for dwelling rooms included standard approved plans estimates, obviously quite important. And so, you know, there's a load of material, I think Mr. Darby refers to it before, that was produced during the course of the application and consideration by both of us in the court. It doesn't appear on here, but it has been for me at times, and that's been great where I'm going to report in terms of parameters and control or managed text. So yes, I mean, we can absolutely do that. That wouldn't be a problem, but I'm just alluding to the fact you're asking Jack's.
Well, like, I wonder if we could have a table with three columns. Tent position, zone plan provision, or provisions, because it might be both policies and all rules and all standards, and a third, comment. And where you derive the information, and obviously the 3,500 square metres for the Shearer's Court, you call it?
The
lakeshore area. That's a derived figure, and we're not saying, give us the measurements, but we just need to understand that there is no, we can't go and check, eyeball a number anywhere that you've derived it, and, but we just need to know that, that was the process.
Right.
And certainly, I think that the council's team had done that in their rebuttal evidence, because they picked out what they could see were the differences. But I think we want to start from the opposite direction. We want to start from position one equals plan version X. And we want to be able to put them alongside each other and eyeball. Now, so we can trust that task to you, we'll carry on.
Well, we do need to follow that up and through the chair, set some sort of timeline.
Yes, well, we're very hard to yes. I was going to wait until the end before we have a complete wish list before discussing the timeline.
Alright, and turning to the farm homestead activity area in paragraph 7.57, you've referred to a mix of small scale commercial activities. And you've given some examples, and we talked earlier with Mr. Carr about conveying and so on. But just can you clarify how what you mean by small scale commercial versus the reference from the next paragraph to the overall scale of retail being limited to 500 square metres?
Well, the capital retail is designed to constrain overall, so if you was in retail, you could move to another design. I guess we're conscious of the framework that we've got for those activities is not either committed or a controlled activity. They will bring visitor accommodation or commercial activities, so a lot of those activities are of the commercial nature and what they are. We have to go through the restricted discretionary activity rule for approved. So there's no presumption that there is an advertised set of commercial activities, but the spread that's in the structure plan and the description that's in paragraph 7.57 is more about setting the intent of what's anticipated for the area to help inform and go going through the season, which was some applications that were made for each initiative because of the commercial activity. So within him, the next layer, if you like, was the cap on retail insurance of 500 square metres overall. There's a further aspect or dimension to any of the buildings which is the makeup of the community base. Issue, which is the standards that have been introduced around the scale of the building, if I can just admit it, and that was done in conjunction with Ms. Fluger. That was around the proximity of the scale of buildings to the road, and to address the Japanese effects. And then lastly, and in response to a conversation that I've had with the bar around concern that this will become an intensive commercial node in its own right, I've proposed further solidification on the footprint area within the site of the drill set. Found its way into the provisions which were in my supplementary evidence. And I've talked about that because the number...
Just before you go on, Troy, could I ask you whether retail is a subset of commercial activity or not?
Yes, it is in my mind. Yes.
And your commercial activities include visitor accommodation?
I think the definition of commercial activity excludes visitor accommodation. Visitor accommodation is paired with commercial activity in the rule, so they capture both.
Sorry.
I'm fairly certain that the definition of commercial activity excludes visitor accommodation.
So you were going on to explain
on repeated page 32 of the revised provisions attached to my documentary events. Over which that will become a restricted search activity, and then a second tier of 3,000, which would then trigger not complaining 30%. And the information which has gone into informing the scale of that particular number was the information provided to me from Value Partners around the scale of that buildings.
So what you're saying then is that what's proposed here is that permitted would be 2,500 square metres. And then
well it's not actually permitted of it because any buildings is going to be in a self-controlled within that area. Any commercial activity is restricted discretionary.
Yes, alright, well what happens between the 2,500 as a restricted discretionary and building coverage above 3,000 is a non-compliant.
So it becomes a non-compliant activity for more than any activity that results in building of more than 3,000 becomes a non-compliant activity.
Yes, but you've got...
What about 2,750?
Yes, between 2,500 and 3,000, what activity standard is proposed for that?
Oh, well, that's the restricted discretion, perhaps this way.
So what
is the standards are expressed within as if you fail to meet the standard set of 2,500, you exceed that standard, then your restricted discretionary
In terms of the activity itself,
irrespective of size.
There is different size. There is different buildings.
So use of existing buildings for commercial activities is not yet.
Correct.
And unless you're going to cart existing buildings away, 2,500 square metres of going is the capacity of the existing buildings, as I understand.
Not quite. The existing buildings, I understand, is possibly 2,300 square metres.
Okay.
Reflecting on the wording, Commissioner, with respect to the total building area of 2,000, I wonder whether it might be improved to use something more along the line which shall be limited in excess of 2,500.
I won't make any comments about that at this stage, but we'll have to see what other clarifications might become apparent. I just want to go through your summary of reasons for proposed provisions under Section 32, considering such clause numbers, but this is paragraph on page 58, can you read it? Paragraph 10.13. You concluded that the proposed zone provides the most appropriate way of achieving the relevant objectives of the proposed plan. And then the reason under C is that it will reduce pressure for such development in other areas of the rural environment where there is finite capacity for residential activity. And I just wondered how you arrived at that conclusion.
Part of the purpose, or part of the development which is enabled by the zone is the 50 residents within the home site overlay, which is a housing opportunity for residential activity. And by providing for that in this location within the framework of the rules, then I think what I'm referring cross-referencing to is some of the policy within the things like Chapter 6 around landscapes that talks about the finite capacity of rural lands for vital opportunity for rural living. And so saying that reflecting on that finite capacity, this is an opportunity to provide for some of that capacity in an appropriate structure framework set of provisions.
I'd also observe that particular policy was the subject of submission by other parties saying it was completely useless because it didn't identify where the finite capacity was, and suggesting it be deleted. Or where the line, where the finite line is met.
Well, that's my other question. Provisions in the proposed revised zone. So I'll turn over to my fellow commissioners.
I could refer to them and see what our commissioner has some breath for me. Page 4.11. I thought of this over afternoon tea after it disappeared from view. I didn't ask Mr. Zabi this question, so I'll ask you since whoever addresses it. You say that
you talked about the lapsing date, and I've discussed lapsing with Council. I think that that's probably not an issue of practice, but you said sequencing a station that consents proven unrealistic from environmental, operational, and economic perspectives. Does unrealistic mean that it won't be implemented? Or is this in the nice to have category?
I think it's more around the process that has transpired in the actual nitty-gritty of implementing the consent is whether it be a realisation or a natural progression from consenting as a construction, that things could be done in a better way. At least costs, at greater benefits, and that's part of the overall evaluation that I've looked at in terms of my section 32 around those costs. And those are the things which I've observed through my involvement or in patient vague developments progress. Obviously I'm not a part of the commercial aspects of any of the decisions on the development, but they're on the receiving end of having to do those changes or making that progression from concepts, plans into the detailed design and finding the level of detail that needs to change in order to sort of come about with better outcomes.
I suppose the obvious observation is, of course, we have experienced practitioners who have acted for applicants before. Every applicant for resource consents wants to preserve maximum flexibility. Every consent authority wants to achieve minimum flexibility. Every submitter opposed in principle and substantive proposal was inflexibility in ways that will never be able to be consummated. And every engineer and every architect advising an applicant who hasn't done a detailed design refuses to put their name to a consent application that locks these things in. We all know that this is part of the process of the tensions of a resource consent process. And we also know, well, I don't feel it because Judge Smith has lectured me on the subject, when he felt that I was pushing the envelope, so to speak, that a resource consent is not a consent in principle. You do have to nail your colours to the mast. And you're talking about progression. And I suppose, surely, the applicant knew that it was getting into strife with the degree of particularity in this particular set of previous consent conditions.
And to a degree, I actually believe that what you said ruined my life, really.
Well, anyone who's acted for applicants or indeed for opponents, that is the practical reality. Which we can talk about because it's pretty much 5 at night, but I want to get to the kernel of that, which is why I put it so directly to you. Is that surely the applicant knew what it was getting into, and
I don't know that I can speak to Mr. Darby in respect of what he was getting into, so I don't really think that's a question that I can answer in that regard. What I probably could observe, having reviewed the decision, is that there were elements of the information that were quite critical and important to arriving at a decision on what was an appropriate development of that site and that landscape. And translating that into a set of provisions, just being a constant challenge, as you've seen them, continually trying to refine that, and other people looking at that and pointing out things that were important too. So that will continue, but I'll try to reflect that the best I can within the provisions to try and capture what I've considered or have seen to be those important parameters that are instrumental at making this determination on consent, such as, for example, the more recent issue around the scale of the project, for example. We've got a developed framework around the energy strategy, but not one that captures the overall scale of what the energy strategy can be. The house sites have replicated the decision in terms of where their locations are, accepting that it's providing for an alternative avenue for buildings to be constructed. Again, it's been trying to set the heights and the RLs and envelope to shape inside the building that would as closely as possible replicate the outcomes for what obviously the court was considering as an important factor in getting this thing over the line. So the way that I've examined and translated the court decision is I've tried to capture as closely as I can those aspects in the book. And I think that's a legitimate approach to for landowners to have developments or enablement or opportunity for the management of the land to be done through a district planning process.
Is the reality because you're making exercise of that judgment, that trailing along behind you, the question we have to ask ourselves is whether we think that some of the things that you haven't translated were critical to the court decision.
Of course.
No pressure. In terms of the updates to the plan provisions, an issue I raised with Carcel this morning was whether, as regards the alteration of the activity areas, firstly shifting the lakeshore area sideways, and secondly expanding the golf course area, does that raise scope slash jurisdiction issues that we should be concerned about, given that that wasn't what part of the concept as originally sought and arguably is a material departure from what was originally sought?
Well, my understanding from the state of Galloway is that just that no, and part of what's important to report and part of what's important there has been the evaluation of the difference of effects. And I'm reliant really on others for what they've said in that regard, especially around the landscape effects by Miss Flicker. And the ecological impacts by Dr. Robert Lindsay, who I understand in relation to the golf course expansion then was of the view that was potentially a positive ecological outcome.
You already got, I understand the argument, so you take your stand on the fact that the effects as per the technical evidence that you're relying on is not material.
Perfect. And that's just based on the comparison of effect. That's not a... I'm not trying to stray into any legal field yet, because other people suggest I'm speaking validly. But if there was more to it than that, then some of this probably drew clouds.
You'll be aware that I can see if you catch your own page.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
So far, so good.
Paragraph 419, the sentence, it's likely that further consequential changes to other chapters may be necessary to identify what controls will apply. At what point are those further consequential changes going to be identified? Like any time within the next 30 seconds, if you will.
Very good. I appreciate it.
No, just joking, but there is a serious point here. That if you're saying that there are other issues hanging out there, how are we supposed to know what they are?
I think the one that was probably on my mind was there's an anticipation by the busy rules because we rely on those. In most other instances, I understand the cross references to be applied across all zones, but I have to admit that would be one I would need to check in the detail, and I don't have the permissions in front of me.
Well, I think that's a good idea to see if I can go on those lists. Something of a loaded question. Do you regard proposed zoning as urban development?
No.
I suppose I should ask you why not. Because Ms. Baker Galloway's former colleague, Mr. Goldsmith, was voluble on the subject in relation to another resort on the other side of the hill.
Right. Well, I've given my opinion as to why it would not be urban development. I think in paragraph 5.27. So I talked about the fact that the residential development of the 50 houses was spread across the 55 hectares. The MT is around about 1.1 kilometres per hectare. The scale of the golf course activity area is 75 hectares. That's unlikely to be accommodated on a rooted land located within the monitoring boundary. The development of activity area C is proposed because of its relationship to the established campground, and which is not located within an urban boundary. That's just as where it is. And the realisation of the environmental benefits, including the indigenous representation, the protection of the open space and the provisions of the network of open trails, directly attributable to the location of the site rather than something which can be replicated elsewhere. Now, all of that is referenced back to the council definition of urban development, which is the Ministry of Planning. And I include that on page 20. As a footnote.
Well, suffice it to say that there has been a recommendation by the staff as a result of a discussion I had with council, or the council suggesting that that definition was meaningless. In these strategic hearings, that a revised definition might be appropriate, utilising what I call the duck principle. It looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, waddles like a duck, it's probably a duck. Applying the same to urban development. Put something more formally by Judge Kirkpatrick and his team in the unitary plan, but that's the essence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's for
do you think it looks like, do you think this development will look like urban development?
No.
Fine. Go no further. If you said yes, there would be a whole train of further inquiry that might follow. I've got no reason to suggest you will. To be able to record your answer for posterity.
It might be that that's from the slider around the policy one I proposed to refer the solution as the landscape effects that are or the landscape solution particularly. And it seems to be that it has general application I thought and use for informing a general understanding of landscape culture, which would give in the future resources more of a heads up and having to do a good principles of view. I said that it hasn't been tested through a process, but it has been like a difference in exploded and refined. It's probably as far as I can take it really, but and that's the battery I probably wrote. The light of those equipment and the conditions with that interested the landscape action.
Just focus on the point I referred to earlier. The final court decision refers to 65 hectares of vegetation, and I was trying to remember what your numbers, minimum numbers were. So it's 2, 8, 9, 22.75. And where's the difference come from?
Different series in the areas that made up the regeneration of native species through retiring from farming and or fencing and allowing them to naturally regenerate. So the interrogated Mr. Parliament the other day, he took me out of the water, and he put the figures which I proposed to which I propose to use to amend some of the policies that I've provided in my revised provisions. But the figures that I just explained, the figures that I had used were referencing to standard as approved plans for the stage 1, stage 2 and stage 3 planting. So there was a set of plans here from the original course plan, but there was a stage 1 plan that showed mitigation planting over the rear,
They're in the derived category. Derived from those plans.
Derived from the plans. There was a stage 2 plan that had a second amount of time, I think it was about 6 hectares and 1 hectare or other. And then there was a third plan which just showed an area of other but didn't have a number. And so his team had given me a number for what it was, and that's what I wrote, how I arrived at those numbers, which I did in the provisions. Now all that was great, except we missed off the regeneration areas. And if you look at the construction plan, there are key versions. There's a farm and vegetation management area, which is attached to the plan. And those areas are what's referred to as the gully. There's one called the gully in the decision at the court. There's another one called the moraine slope. And there were some other wetland areas going towards Plus. Then there was another area, a further area, which is the area, I'll just point it out, might be easiest. So, I don't know, you might not be able to see, but the moraine slope up was here, the gully was on here, the wetland was in this area here, and then there was a further area that was extended around here that included around the bluffs, around the back of the bluffs here, that included areas for native regeneration. So it wasn't really planting, it was just stop exclusion and owners to regenerate. And that was where I understand the overall figures came from, of 65 hectares.
Well, I spoke to Craig. The issue of going in the rules.
It is, but
it does mean that there would have to be, in terms of what we're doing, I'd like to make some corrections to that.
Well, we'll talk about them if they're in corporate, and I understand now the difference. So we'll talk about that in the context of the detailed rules. Public access trials, paragraph 43 of your supplementary orders. This is an issue more appropriate to discuss in the context of the zoning provisions. We'll wait at that point. But the essential question that was in my mind is how zone rules can lock in positive obligations when zone provisions are necessarily only enabling. Like you have standards for new trails. Where does the obligation to create the trail to those standards come from if you're operating within a zone framework?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand the question, to be honest, because again, the intent was to, especially the intent, maybe let's get away. The intent was to try and capture the obligations we put on the consent that they wanted to serve around public access trials to make sure that they were provided for. So there was two elements to the rule, generally speaking. There was the standards about where they should go and where they should connect to. And that was the first part of the rule. That includes the standard of that formation, its alignment, where it goes and what it connects to. And that's been provided for and shown on the structure plan. And to the part from that, would require or trigger requirement for consent, and I think it's a restricted discretion activity. Now, the second part of the rule was the bit that goes to when that should be done and securing the obligation of the landowner to do that, to do the work. And on reflection and discussion with Mr. Barber, I could see at the point that a restricted discretion activity rule framework might give an opportunity for the landowner to step back from that through a consent process. And the repeated important part of the decision on the landowner's consent. And I suggested that be elevated in the status to not comply for a breach of when those public access routes are formed. But for some backgrounds, it was clear that the easements for the most part had already been created. And the public access right, by and large, my understanding has been created. So it's just the force of the provisions is really about making them go to them, form the trials within that easement.
Yes, I suppose that's at the heart of my question, which is the consent condition. You could tie that as a condition to consent for the houses. And in a zone framework, setting out as a separate set of provisions, not that, as you say, that the legal aspects of access have been completed. There was a positive obligation to form, maintain the trail. Come from.
I think you need to be taken through how that stands.
To the rule discussion.
Between main public trails and the stage at which the development gets to, whereby that has to be done.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, just hold that thought. You take me through it, you know, to explain it, because I think it's what I'm missing is something. It's in the character of a friend is, by definition, enabling. What happens if no one applies for a consent?
Well, I think this has been turned around to apply to activities that require some form of consent. So, there would be a breach of the rule if the developer, for example, didn't form public access trail number one prior to the operation of the golf course. So there would be an enforcement issue creating that respect.
Well,
others like public access trail number two and links to the 24 seats for the certificate for the 10 pump sites. So the council in that case could withhold the issue of the 24 seats for the enforcement, for example. So
it sounds like you have it out by two places, you just need to take it to the person. So that was all I had in the realist. Commissioner McLeod.
Right. Yeah, hopefully. A bit need in your evidence and other people's evidence about how onerous some of the consent conditions were, the chair referred to from an economic perspective, and you referred to it in the trail, specifically at the beginning of the development, is very onerous on the developer. To put it bluntly, suck it up, honey. You know, at what point do you just go, look, this just needs to happen? And it's all very well to say it's onerous on the developer, but the developer went into it with the eyes open. Good point. Am I off the mark? It's just for them.
I don't know if there's a question in here, but
there is.
Fair point, sure.
I understand your view. I also understand the importance behind the commercial imperatives lining up with the environmental obligations, and if they can better align, they often get better developments, in my experience.
Agreed, but the for example, in the environment court, it was the developer that offered up the options to be done.
Oh,
it could be argued that there's a second bite of the cherry being done.
I completely agree with the material that was put under the consent, but it sounded from the evidence of Mr. Darby that was prepared by the applicants. And I wasn't involved in that process. All I know is that it's since proven to be difficult for them to work through commercially sensitive staging, which the cost of some of those elements, as it relates to the sale of the house, which helps fund it. But I accept your point that the nature of the consent submissions would reflect what was happening at the course of time in the process of doing the consent. And it's taking the opportunity through the consent process to make that more workable. But the important thing in my mind, and again it comes back to the environmental principle in my mind, is that it is done. Particularly with respect to securing benefits around the public access trails. From an environmental perspective, I don't know that there is, effects done on the 10th house or the 11th floor. I don't know. It's just the fact that it is there, that they do secure the public benefit, and that will step down from that. It's an important point for me, that was saying. And that's reflected in just the explanation of the status of that timing.
Windows done,
how
they went to the
development.
Fair enough. The one point in page 57, you go into the benefits versus the costs. of effectiveness of the provisions, and there's one about under economic benefit. The zoning will also provide ongoing development credit and giving support to continued investment, development and wider enhancements. What are the wider enhancements?
Well, the revegetation strategy is a good example of that, because it's, you'll see the provisions that we've got of looking at a minimum, setting a minimum in terms of that. They don't cap and limit that, so there is a possibility for greater areas for regeneration or replanting to occur. And in fact, that has been the case from what I've observed in the implementation of the consent that seems to be occurring.
Okay, so let's take Galloway. Looking at my watch, it's now 10 to 6. There are two options here. We could take 5 minute adjournment. We could raid the council supply of chucky bickies to keep you and your witness and the commissioners going. I'll mention some coffee. Or we could return in the morning. That would require you to prevail on your Reverend colleague Ms. Hill, who is scheduled to arrive at 10 a.m. tomorrow with Sunny Heights. Sunny Heights has significantly constrained the relief it's seeking, and while it's set down for the entire morning 10 to 1, I would be astounded if it took more than an hour. I think it's really important that we work through the planning provisions with Mr. Ferguson. I think as far as the commissioners are concerned, it has to be done tonight. So I call 5 minutes adjournment anyway, and you can talk to your team about as I say, provided on this hill.
Yes, well, no, I think we're going with that actually, because we're just much better than it is.
Mr. Page.
I can't be here in the morning, sir, and I might be interested in Mr. Ferguson's answers to your questions. I would suggest that you get the option.
Well, vote tonight or bust.
Right.
I'm wearing a
hand, but
we can carry on.
5 minutes, German, to raise the
chocolate. We're on it.